there's a lot, Robertson, there's a lot of refreshments, so it's not a problem. There's plenty of refreshments, so if he stays, you know, we'll work it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome you all this evening to our JEP Identity Lecture. It's a real pleasure to be back at the home of Chani and Howie Bricks, who over the years have opened their home to our events with not only lectures but classes as well, and they have special joy. They take real pleasure in not only being hospitable but especially extending themselves to be able to share the beauty of Torah. So we want to let you know how pleased we are to be back. Our being here, we hope, will be a zechus, a great merit for you and your dear family to be blessed with the very best of health and a lot of Yiddish and Nachas and real simcha and Yetz Hashem. I would say that at this particular point, I would like to start off by saying to all of you, Mazel Tov! What did you do? So I'm going to tell you. So why am I giving you a Mazel Tov? We know that today was the eighth day of Hanukkah. And, you know, we know that during each of the 8 days of Hanukkah, the miracle of the oil continuing to burn became a more extensive miracle. So on day number two, when the boiled dirt, the oil burned one extra day, so all right, so they had a one-day miracle. So on and so forth. By the time the eighth day rolled around, that was the greatest miracle of all. So our sages tell us that on each of the 8 days of Hanukkah, there is a potential for miracles to occur. And the eighth day of Hanukkah is the day with the greatest potential for miracles to occur. So I would like to mention, some of you may have already heard about the miracle that occurred. Approximately 4 hours ago, Mordechai Rabashkin was released from prison by presidential pardon. He spent 8 years, he was sentenced, I believe, for 27 years on trumped up charges. So it took President Trump to get him out of jail. So, I can tell you that there is widespread celebration in Jewish communities from coast to coast. So, that's why I say Mazel Tov. And the fact that this happened on the eighth day of Hanukkah, which has such a potential for miracles, is something that certainly is no coincidence. Baruch Hashem. I would also like to mention that tonight we have our lecture in memory of the dear parents of Robertson Deitch, who was with us this evening. Baruch Hashem, her parents were Nathan and Lena Seiler. And first of all, where's the Robertson? Looking for you. Oh, there you are. Yes, we of course we're delighted that you are able to be with us. And of course, Robertson Leibowitz as well. It's a great honor to have both of you with us.
My privilege.
Robertson Deitch's parents were two individuals who were, had a passion for helping their fellow Jew, and they had a particularly great passion for strengthening the fledgling Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael soon after it, got off the launch pad. And this passion for giving and sharing is something that the Robertson definitely picked up from her parents, and she has been carrying on with that mission. And she did so, of course, together with her late husband, Rabbi Yaakov Deitch. Most of you here, but not all of you here, knew Rabbi Yaakov Deitch. He was the co-director of JEP of Westchester with myself during the last 5 years of his life. And as I have often said, he's the closest that I ever got to having a brother. I have two sisters, Baruch Hashem, but I never had a physical brother, but he was the closest that I got to having a real brother. We learned together, we schmoozed together, we just, what can I tell you? And so the lecture tonight is in memory of the Rebbetzin's parents, and we hope and we pray that the inspiration that we will gain this evening will elevate their departed neshamos in Mirz Hashem. And you, Rebbetzin, and your whole mishpacha should be gebenched with long life, good health, a lot of Yiddish and Nachas.
Amen.
Now, Chanukah was very beautiful, very inspirational, and last night we all lit the menorah with the 8 candles, and I noticed tonight when I came home for dinner, we did not light the menorah. So, it's like a little bit of a downer, we're lighting the menorah every night, seeing Moshe Tzua, now that's it, the show's over, But I think we really need something to perk us up tonight. We don't have the menorah lighting, so we got something really special to perk us up tonight in the form of Rabbi Chaim Schwartz. As our lecturer this evening, he is an individual that I've had the privilege of not just knowing, but being very close friends with. I guess we're talking now in excess of, what?
30 years.
30 years? I thought it was more like 40. Okay. All right.
Upwards of 30.
30, okay. in any event, Rabbi Schwartz is he's been involved in the administration on the executive level of the yeshiva where I was ordained, the Rabbinical Seminary of America, Yeshiva Chofetz Chaim, which is currently located in Kew Gardens. And for the last, he's been involved in the, on the executive level for the last 22 years. And for the last 9 years, he's been the executive vice president of the entire yeshiva. Now, it's important to realize one thing so you could appreciate Rabbi Schwartz's role, what he's doing, what he's all about. The yeshiva, where we both studied and where we were both ordained, is the yeshiva that is involved in trying to start different schools, projects, synagogues, yeshivas all across the country. When I came to the yeshiva back in 1968, I came to the yeshiva. And by the way, I didn't know a soul in the yeshiva. And it just so happens that Rabbi Deitch, of blessed memory, invited my wife and I. Well, then we were just an engaged couple. We came to the house for lunch, and we asked him a lot of questions about the yeshiva. And I'm not going to tell you the whole story. The rest is history, but here we are tonight. In any event, the yeshiva at that time, there was just one yeshiva. It was a small yeshiva. It was started during the Depression years. It almost folded a couple of times. When I came to the yeshiva, there were 60 students in the yeshiva, 5 married couples, newly married couples, and no kids. And largely, not solely, but largely due to the dedication of Rabbi Schwartz, the yeshiva has expanded. Now the yeshiva has over 20 yeshivos from coast to coast, and also in Eretz Yisrael as well. And the yeshiva has been spreading Torah, opening outreach programs. As a matter of fact, Jeff of Westchester, beginning, had a great deal to do with Rabbi Leibowitz, who was the one who, I brought up the idea of starting something, and he kept on pushing me. We got to make it happen. And here we are. So what can I say, Rabbi Schwartz? You're making a huge difference in communities from coast to coast. I just want you to know, aside from his executive role, Rabbi Schwartz, one-on-one, is an exceptional person. We last had Rabbi Schwartz speak for us, I think it was 4 years ago, if I'm correct. And the day after Rabbi Schwartz spoke, I got a phone call the next morning. Somebody asked, he said, I was there at the lecture last night. This guy was a great speaker. Do you think it would be all right if I gave him a call and asked if I could meet him? So I said, sure. So I gave him the phone number. He called up, and he made an appointment to see this guy. We'll see Rabbi Schwartz. I mean, Rabbi Schwartz met this first person, and they have a very close relationship that's developed over the last 4 years. In fact, this individual who happens to be sitting in a room tonight studies Torah with Rabbi Schwartz every week for the last number of years. That's just a little sample of, this man's warmth and charisma and sincerity. Without further ado, Rabbi Schwartz, it is our honor and
thank
privilege
you very much.
To have you come forward.
Thank you, Rabbi Zaitchik. My father would have appreciated that introduction, and my mother would have believed it. It's really a pleasure to be here with you tonight and to hopefully share some words of Torah and some wisdom in honor of the post-Hanukkah period that we're in tonight. As Rabbi Zaitchik said, I too was in my home this afternoon and looked at the empty menorah, and it was a slightly sad feeling because Hanukkah is over. And I said to one of my children, I said, Rosh Hashanah was just yesterday, and now Hanukkah is over, so Pesach is tomorrow. But, don't worry, not exactly tomorrow. But the point is that, we do need, especially as we're entering the winter months, it's cold outside, the days are short, and the rabbis always teach us that when the days get short and the nights are long, it's a very special merit to study Torah at night. Our topic tonight is, against all odds, the secret behind the survival of the Jew. And the survival of the Jew can be a little bit depressing, because we've had a rocky road over the last 3,500 years. But we're going to try to avoid most of the depressing parts, and we're going to try to focus a little bit on some of the more uplifting parts. So I have a handout, if you wouldn't mind handing them out to the people behind you. Okay. If anyone else needs... Okay. One of the most famous French mathematicians was someone by the name of Blaise Pascal. And Pascal lived in the mid-1600s, and he was an inventor, he was a writer, he was a philosopher. He actually invented the mechanical calculator. Many of you may remember when you were younger, you would go into a grocery store, and they had an old-style cash register with where they pressed down the buttons and maybe they pulled the lever to tally up all the order. So Pascal invented the first mechanical calculator. And he was a brilliant scientist. He developed a law of physics that is still used and quoted today in all physics books. It's the law of the principle of the transmission of fluid pressure. I'm not going to get into all the details, but it is still in vogue, it's still true, and it's still discussed and analyzed in science classrooms throughout the world today. He also developed Pascal's theorem of projective geometry, which I'm also not going to get into with you tonight, or you'll all be asleep. But it has been proven, and it works. And for those who are involved in higher-level mathematics, it's something that is used on a regular basis. Pascal wrote a book that was actually published after he passed away. And in this book, he talks about the Jewish people, because he was an ardent Christian, and one of the things that the ardent Christians like to do is always analyze the Jewish people. So he wrote, whereas the nations of Greece and Italy, Sparta, Athens, Rome, and others have long since perished, the Jews ever remain. And in spite of the endeavors of many powerful kings who have 100 times tried to destroy them, they have nevertheless been preserved. This is what this brilliant French mathematician noticed, that everyone has tried to destroy the Jews. All the nations of the world, and the nations that he mentioned, Greece and Sparta and Athens and Rome, these were world powers. These were empires that ruled the entire known world at their time. And they have come and they have gone, and the Jews are still here. There's a famous story they tell about Rabbi Kahaneman. Rabbi Kahaneman was the administrator and the founder of the Panovej Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. We're actually going to speak more about the Panovej Yeshiva in Bnei Brak a little bit later this evening. But Rabbi Kahaneman was once in Rome on a fundraising trip. And he went to the Arch of Titus. This was the arch that Titus's brother built in honor of his brother Titus, who was the leader of the Roman legions that destroyed the Second Temple. And after the destruction of the Second Temple, and after Judea had been turned into a captive state, Titus brought 300,000 Jewish slaves back to Rome, and he paraded them through the streets of Rome. And his brother erected a stone archway called the Arch of Titus. And on this archway, there is an image of the Roman legionnaires carting off the precious vessels from the Holy Temple. So the Jewish community of Rome, which has been there since then, and even before, for almost 2,000 years, they have a tradition that they don't walk through the arch. They don't want to show any respect for Titus, who destroyed our temple. So Rabbi Kahaneman was in Rome. He went to see the arch. He took off his shoe, and he started pounding on the outside of the arch. And he called out in a loud voice. He said, "Titus! Titus! Where are you?" And he said in Yiddish, he said, "Mir zaynen da. We're still here. We are still here. You wanted to destroy us. You destroyed our temple. You laid waste to our country. And we're still here. Where are you?" And that is what we're here to talk about tonight. The secret of the survival of the Jews. We're here in Scarsdale. Right next door, there is a very large synagogue, the Young Israel of Scarsdale. On a Shabbos, there could possibly be 500-600 people coming to pray in this shul. And there are classes, and there are lectures, and there are teen activities, and there are youth activities. I'm sure there's activities for babies, and mommy and me, and all kinds of activities going on. It's one of the most active synagogues in Westchester County. We're still here. In spite of everything that everyone has tried to do to us, we're still here. Leo Tolstoy, a famous Russian novelist. I think everyone has heard of Tolstoy. He wrote, "What is the Jew? What kind of unique creature is this, whom all the rulers of all the nations of the world have disgraced and crushed and expelled and destroyed, persecuted, burned, and drowned? And despite all their anger and fury, the Jew continues to live and to flourish. Who is this creature?" He was just astounded. Clearly, the Jewish people excel at survival. So you might think that we're all built like Arnold Schwarzenegger or the Hulk. You know, we're built strong, we're mighty, we're hardy individuals. Last week, a Jew passed away in Israel, and he was the leader of the Jewish community, of the religious Jewish community. His name was Rabbi Steinman. You may have heard of him, you may have read about him. Was he strong like Arnold Schwarzenegger? Was he big like the Hulk? Was he a mighty, hefty person? He was 104 years old when he passed away. So one of the Israeli reporters interviewed one of his family members. His daily consumption of food was a cucumber, a boiled potato, and a few spoonfuls of oatmeal. For years, that was his daily consumption. He was a little frail man. If you would see him sitting in the shul on the side, you wouldn't have given him a second look. You'd think, an old timer, you know, someone sitting in the shul. If you were in Brooklyn and saw him in a shtiebel, you would think that he had been there for 20 years. When he was 95 years old, 9 years ago, he undertook a world tour to strengthen Jewish communities. He came here to New York. He went to Los Angeles. He went to Chicago. And wherever he went, throngs of people came to see him. They just wanted to see his smile, just to be in his presence. And they asked some of the people, "Why are you here?" They said, "We just feel uplifted being in his presence." Was he Arnold Schwarzenegger? Was he the survivalist? Was he a person mighty and strong that can survive persecution? He was a little frail man. If you would have looked at him the wrong way, you probably could have broken him. But he was a survivor. He lived 104 years. And when he passed away, hundreds of thousands of people came to his funeral. His funeral, as per his instructions, was within 6 hours after he passed away. Most of the buses in the state of Israel were chartered to take groups to his funeral. And there was a reporter for Channel 2 News in Israel. There aren't that many networks in Israel. There's Channel 1, Channel 2, and I think Channel 4. I don't think there's even a Channel 3. But one of the reporters for Channel 2 was driving home on a highway. And he said for 2.5 miles, the highway just had buses parked on the side of the highway. Because the buses couldn't get into the streets where the funeral was, so they just parked on the side and people walked. And he said to him, he wrote in a, in an op-ed piece in one of the secular Israeli newspapers, he said, you know, this is an amazing thing. One man passes away and hundreds of thousands of people come to his funeral to pay their final respects. And he said, you know, we can learn from this type of lifestyle. What is the point of surviving as a Jew if we're going to be living with relentless persecution and torment? If we're going from one Holocaust to the next. So what's the point? Is there a reason we should survive for thousands of years and dust ourselves off, and when they throw us out of one country, we'll go to another country just so that they can attack us again, just so that they can kill us again? Is there a point? If we look at Jewish history, what we will see is that there are times of torment and there are peaceful times. And the peaceful times are only interludes between our ordeals. For example, we've been living here in the United States of America since 1776. And America has been very, very good to the Jews. We have freedom of religion. We have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. We have the Bill of Rights. We're protected. And we have been very comfortable here in the America and in North America. We're able to build a synagogue. We're able to build a yeshiva. In some communities, you can even build an Erev. In others, you might have to go to court in order to build an Erev. But I'm proud to say that not a single Erev in the United States of America has ever successfully been challenged in court. The American legal system has upheld the right of the Jewish community in every single community in the 50 states where it has been legally challenged. And the rights of the Jewish community to have an Erev and to observe the Shabbos and to carry on Shabbos has always been upheld. Even in places where I didn't believe it would stand up, like in West Hampton, where you've got all the money in the world and the biggest lawyers in the world ready to say, we will defend our community, but the courts have always upheld an Erev. We've been very comfortable here in America. But let's take a page out of Pascal's book. If the ardent Christians are always looking at the Jews, so us as Jews, we can always look at the other nations as well. Let's take a look at the people living in Egypt today. What do you call them? Egyptians. Are the Egyptians today, are they the descendants of the pharaohs? I don't think so. Are the people living in Italy, the kings of Pecco Romano and the kings of pizza and the kings of cannolis, are they the descendants of the Italians from 2,000 years ago? Are the people living in Rome today, are they the descendants of the Romans who destroyed the Holy Temple? Should we travel to Rome and start beating up all the people in the streets in Rome because your grandpappy destroyed the temple that my grandpappy prayed in? Your grandfather took my grandfather as a slave. They're not the descendants of those Romans. The truth is, no one knows for sure. No one really cares. Everyone's just happy to have good pizza. The point is that the offspring of the nations of the world are not connected to the nations that existed in antiquity. With the Jews, though, we are the descendants of our forefathers. What's the greatest threat to the survival of an ancient people? Well, there's invasion, subjugation, enslavement, relocating the population, and assimilation into another population. So, for example, during the Peloponnesian Wars, when Sparta went to war against Athens, Sparta won, and they subjugated the Athenians, and they forced many of the Athenians to move to a different city. They lost their language, they lost their culture, and they adapted, and they became integrated into their new society. When the Second Temple was destroyed, you had hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Israel. And the Romans came, and they swept through the land of Israel, and all the Jewish people who could retreated into the city of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem ended up being one of the last strongholds of the Jewish people in that era. And the Jews tried to resist. And there were differences of opinion. And the Talmud in the Gemara in Gittin describes very carefully what transpired. There were different groups vying for control of the resources and the facilities in Jerusalem. One of these groups was called the Baryonim. They were a Jewish gang, almost like the Stern gang was operating in pre-mandate Palestine. And the Stern gang would run raids against the British to try to get them to leave. So the Baryonim were operating in Jerusalem at the time of the Roman occupation. And they were tough guys. And they controlled the gates on the inside of Jerusalem. The Romans had constructed a siege around Jerusalem. They surrounded the city with tens of thousands of legionaries. And the Baryonim were watching inside. Sometimes they staged raids against the Romans. The leader of the Jewish community was someone by the name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's nephew was the leader of this Jewish gang of the Baryonim. His name was Abba Sikra. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai worked with his nephew to gain exit from the city. He wanted to leave Jerusalem. Not because he wanted to go to Miami, and not because he wanted to find a better place to live. He wanted to go and talk to Vespasian. Vespasian was the Roman general in charge of the siege. And the Gemara in Gittin describes the interaction between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Vespasian. If you look on the handout on the top right of the first page, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai came to Vespasian and he greeted him as a king. And Vespasian says, well, I'm not a king, I'm just a general. If you're calling me a king, you should be put to death because Nero is the Caesar. Nero is off in Rome. And they were talking back and forth, and while they were talking, a messenger arrived to tell Vespasian that Nero had abdicated the throne in Rome. And the Roman Senate had selected Vespasian as the new emperor of Rome. So while Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was there at his audience with Vespasian, and after he had called him the king, he was then notified that he had become the king. And Vespasian was amazed at the prescience of this rabbi, at his wisdom. And Vespasian tried to put on his boots, and he couldn't get his boots on his feet. And he looks at Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and says, "Why don't my boots fit me?" And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, "There is a verse that says that when a person receives good tidings, their limbs swell." He said, "You were told that you're the new emperor. Your feet swell. They don't fit in the boots." I think that's where the phrase comes from: if your shoe fits, wear it. So he says, "Well, if you're full of so much wisdom, how do I get my limbs to shrink?" He said, "Think of someone you don't like." And that's what he did. And a few moments later, he was able to fit his feet into his boots. So the Talmud then says, Vespasian said to him, "I am going back to Rome. I will send another man to take my place." This man that he sent was his son Titus. Vespasian was Titus's father. "So ask me now for something I can give you." Basically, Vespasian was offering Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai three wishes. Everyone is always talking about finding a magic lamp and getting three wishes. He says, "Ask me for something and I'll grant it." Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "Give me the town of Yavne and its sages." Yavne was a little village halfway between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. It's still there today. He said, "Give me that town and its sages. Also give me the family of Rabbi Gamliel." Rabbi Gamliel was a direct descendant of King David. He was, his father and his grandfather had been the Nasi, the leader, the president of the Jewish community. And Jewish tradition states that a descendant of King David should always be the leader of the Jewish community. And the Mashiach, the Messiah, will be Mashiach ben David. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked of Vespasian, "Please preserve for me the family of Rabbi Gamliel. Just give me that family." He didn't tell him why, because if he would have said, "Well, he's a prince, he's from the family of King David, he's the key to the future of Jewish leadership," Vespasian would have said, "Well, I'm going to do away with that family." He just said, "Well, in honor of King David, he's a descendant of King David, you know, for old time's sake, preserve that family." "Va'asvei demisayilei l'Rabbi Tzadok," and give me doctors to cure Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok was like a modern day Rabbi Steinman. He was an elderly Jew, very holy. And for 40 years before the temple was destroyed, he fasted every day and prayed to Hashem to spare the Jewish people, to have mercy on the Jewish people. For 40 years he fasted. After 40 years of not eating, you're not going to be in such good shape. So he asked for doctors to cure Rabbi Tzadok. So three very strange requests. Okay? you're in an audience with the person who just became the emperor of Rome. And he says, okay, I'm leaving town, ask me for what you want. So what did he ask for? He didn't ask him to spare the temple. He knew he wouldn't give that. That's why he was there in the first place. He said, give me the town of Yavne and its sages. What was so special about Yavne? So the Maharal Prague explains, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, who was the chief rabbi of the city of Prague in Czechoslovakia. If anyone has ever been to Czechoslovakia, his synagogue is still standing. It's the oldest synagogue building still standing in Europe. The Germans, the Nazis, didn't destroy it for some strange reason. Legend has it that Rabbi Lowy was the one who formed the Golem of Prague to protect the Jewish community, and the remnants of this golem are in the attic still in the shul. But you can go to see his synagogue still today. In his commentary to this piece of the Talmud, Rabbi Lowy explains that Yavne, everyone who lived in the town was a Torah scholar. And they didn't only study the Torah, they taught the Torah. So you had an entire village, an entire town, filled with teachers of Torah. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai requested from Vespasian, from the emperor himself, that this town and its scholars should be under the direct protection of Rome. What did he accomplish? He accomplished the survival of the Jewish people. Because with this one request, he secured the future leadership of the Jewish people. You would have people who were knowledgeable in Torah, and people who were able to teach Torah. People prepared to share that knowledge with others. So even if it was just a few hundred people. But when things calmed down, and after the Romans left, and after all the fires were put out, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai knew that we would have to start again. And by securing the safety of Yavne and its scholars, he was able to secure future Torah teachers for the Jewish community. And why did he ask for a doctor to heal Rabbi Tzadok? Because Rabbi Tzadok was the model of authentic prayer. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, after this terrible destruction, after the horrific, terrible things that the Romans were doing to the population, people would say, what's the point in praying? What's the point in prayer? God wouldn't let this happen. We needed someone who could be a genuine, holy man that people could look at and say, there is a reason to pray. There is a reason to reach out to God. There is a God to talk to. And by protecting the family of Rabbi Gamliel, he was able to protect the Davidic royal line. Down till today. Today we're all confused. We're all mixed up. We don't know which tribe we're from. We don't know which family we're from. But some people walking around, possibly even here in Scarsdale, possibly even here in this room, there may be someone who's a descendant of King David and who might be the father or the mother of Mashiach. Just like there are people today who know that they're a Kohen. Why? Because my father was a Kohen. There are people who know that they're a Levi because their family has been Levium as far as they knew. So too, we have the royal line of King David. So what has kept the Jewish people alive since the destruction of the temple? It's been the Torah. We had no more land. We had no more center. We had no more sovereignty. But we had something that we could take with us. Wherever we were scattered, whether it was to Italy, or Greece, or North Africa, or Europe, and later to America, Australia, New Zealand, Russia, wherever Jews would end up, Peru, South America, Buenos Aires, we had the Torah. We could take the Torah with us. We could adhere to our traditions. And keeping the faith has kept the Jewish people alive for the last 2,000 years. As one famous Jewish writer wrote, more than the Jews keep Shabbos, Shabbos keeps the Jews. Because when someone observes Shabbos, it's like having a sign outside a store. As long as you have a sign outside a store, you know that the store is open. When someone takes the sign down, then you know the store is out of business. So keeping the faith, keeping Jewish traditions, lighting a Hanukkah menorah, that has kept the Jews alive. That has helped us stay the course throughout history. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was one of the greatest Jewish minds of the 18th century. He lived in Hamburg, Germany, and he had been the chief rabbi of a town called Emden in Germany, and that's why he took the name of the town as his last name. He observed the Jews of his time that they were studying the same Torah texts that their grandparents had studied. And he thought about this. And he said, you know, those grandparents, they were studying the same Torah text as their grandparents. And their grandparents were studying the same text as their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, going back thousands of years. And he wrote that, you know what? This is the greatest miracle of all. He wrote in one of his books, in the introduction to his commentary on the Siddur, that the survival of the Jews through the generations, through the study of Torah, is a greater miracle than the crossing of the Red Sea. Now I would say that the greatest miracle in the last 1,000 years was the 69 Mets. But Rabbi Emden says this was even a bigger miracle. The survival of the Jewish people is the greatest miracle known to mankind. If you look on the third page of the handout, a rabbi prepared the chain of transmission from Sinai till today. And this is basically the transmission of the Torah from leader to student until the student becomes the leader. And it's a little bit frightening, but it's only 129 generations back to Moses. We are the 129th generation since God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai. And if you go back 10 generations, that's where Rabbi Emden was. And he passed away in 1776. Just think about what has happened in the world since 1776. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, World War I, World War II, the creation of the State of Israel, the expulsion of all the Jewish people from the Sephardic countries, the decimation of the Jews in Europe. And we're still here. And we are here today because we are still studying the same Torah that our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents studied. And our texts are the same. And the Torah is still the same. There's a noted historian that many people have heard of. His name is Rabbi Beryl Wein. Rabbi Wein has produced over 1,000 lectures on Jewish history and on Jewish topics. In the 80s and 90s, he was the number one best-selling lecturer on Jewish history audio cassettes. Tens of thousands of his cassettes were sold. And he is famous for saying that the greatest gift that ever happened to the Jews was the fact that the Italians in Venice put us into a ghetto. And that the Italians created the ghetto. Now, for those who don't know, ghettos were not a pretty place. A ghetto was a confined area. You had to live within the confining physical space of the ghetto. You couldn't leave the ghetto. You had to work in the ghetto. You had to go to school in the ghetto. You had to live in the ghetto, and food was scarce. And it was always crowded, and people got sick, and because they were living in such close proximity with each other, disease was easily spread from family to family. So why does Rabbi Wein say that the ghetto was the best thing that ever happened to the Jews? He explains because it forced us to focus on ourselves and our families. It forced us to focus on our studies. It locked us away from all the distractions of the world. Within the ghetto, it was just us. And within the ghetto, you had to live, you had to study, you had to work. And it forced us to develop in ways that we could not have developed ourselves had we not been so incarcerated. It also forced us to focus on our Torah studies. Over the years, we have heard many stories about those who persevered in Europe. They were in difficult situations during the Shoah, during the Holocaust, and they strengthened themselves. They lit Hanukkah candles out of pieces of potato and all kinds of stories. I want to share with you a story I don't think you've ever heard before. On the bottom of the first page, or occupying most of the first page, there's the title page from a book. This book is called Avi Ezri. And this book was written by Rabbi Elazar Menachem Shach. Rabbi Shach was born in 1899 in a town in Lithuania called Vabolnik. And right before World War II, right before, at the very beginning of 1940, he was able, with the assistance of an uncle, to secure passage out of Europe. He did not come to America. Instead, he went to Palestine, to British Mandate Palestine. And in Palestine, he was able to get a job teaching at a Jewish elementary school. Eventually, he was recognized for being a tremendous, tremendous scholar, and he became the head of the Panevez Yeshiva, the one we spoke about with Rabbi Kahaneman before. That yeshiva is in Bnei Brak till today. It is one of the largest yeshivas in Israel or in the world. It has thousands of students. Many tourists go to see the Panevez Yeshiva because about 30 years ago, a community in Italy, they tore down their synagogue. And this synagogue had a hand-carved Torah ark that was gilded in 14 karat gold. And when they tore down the shul, they tore down the synagogue, they said, what are we going to do with this gorgeous ark? And someone heard about it, and someone connected them, and they sent the piece, they took the ark apart, and they sent the pieces to this yeshiva in Bnei Brak. And you go today to this yeshiva, one of my children was there. They say it's the most amazing, stunning thing, because you have this big room filled with people studying Torah, and in the front, there is the most massive, gorgeous, golden ark. It stands, I think, 2.5 stories tall, and it reflects the sunlight, and it's just spectacular. So Rabbi Shach was the leader of that yeshiva. He passed away in 2011. He was 103 years old when he passed away. He also was not built like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he still lasted 103 years. What's interesting about this book, Avi Ezri, it is a commentary on Maimonides, technical halachic writings. Now, Maimonides lived 1,000 years ago. We're still talking about him today. But he lived 1,000 years ago, and his writings are not simple. They're complex. Rabbi Shach's commentary on Maimonides' writings are some of the most complex writings that have been written in Jewish life in the last 100 years. Maybe even 200 years. Reading an Avi Ezri is almost impossible. It's so complicated. You need to have numerous layers and levels of understanding to understand what he is saying and to understand what Maimonides is saying. What is interesting about this first volume of Avi Ezri is if you look in the middle, it says that it was printed in Yerushalayim in Tuf Shin Ches. Four lines from the bottom. Yerushalayim in Tuf Shin Ches. That means it was printed in Jerusalem in 1948. So I saw this the first time a number of years ago, and I was interested. Jerusalem in 1948 was not a peaceful place. You had the Jordanians bombarding the Jewish community of Jerusalem day and night. You had the Jordanian legion had been trained by the British. They were well equipped, they were well trained, and they were attacking Jerusalem. So I was curious, when during 1948 did Rabbi Shach write this Avi Ezri. So there's an introduction. And I cut out the last two lines of this introduction. It says, Hakosev Bedima. And I write these words of introduction with tears. Yerushalayim in Jerusalem, Hanesuna Kayom B'Matzor U'B'Matzok. I'm writing this in the city of Jerusalem, which is today in great danger and in tremendous fear. Mibachutz Tiskal Harav, from outside they're marching against us. Umehadrim Ema, and within we are filled with dread. Hayom, today, Erev Shabbos Kodesh Parshas Bahar. I looked up on a Jewish calendar from 1948. When was Erev Shabbos Parshas Bahar? Bahar is one of the 54 Parshios, 54 sections of the Torah reading. So Friday of Parshas Bahar in 1948 was on May 28th. 14 days after the State of Israel was proclaimed.
I'm sorry, there's a Toyota Avalon, someone left their lights on.
The keys are in my coat pocket.
Is that your car,
Rabbi? I think so. So Rabbi Shach finished his Avi Ezri, and he finished writing the introduction on May 28, 1948. Now, this work of original thought required massive amounts of concentration, massive amounts of focus. What was going on around him? There were grenades exploding in the street. There were enemy aircraft bombarding the Jewish community. The Jordanian Legion was shelling the Jewish community. And in some basement, somewhere, Rabbi Shach, who at the time was 47 or 48 years old, was sitting by a desk and was focusing on the words of a rabbi who lived 1,000 years before. And he was focusing with tremendous intensity and with tremendous concentration so that he was able to plumb to the depths of his understanding. The fact that there was no food didn't matter. The fact that there was no water didn't matter. The fact that his life was in danger, the fact that there was a war going on outside the window, it didn't matter. When you travel to Israel today, and I hope everyone in this room has had that opportunity, as you drive on Route 1 to Jerusalem, on the left side, there are the relics of some trucks. These relics used to be in the middle median of the highway, but now they took away the median. They moved the trucks to the side. Those trucks are all that's left of a convoy that was attempting to break through the Arab lines to bring food, water, and medical supplies to Jerusalem during the siege of Jerusalem at exactly this time. So there was no food, there was no water, there was nothing. And Rabbi Shach is sitting in a basement, and he's sitting by his sfarim, he's sitting by his books, and he has put all these worldly experiences beside him to understand, what does the Rambam mean? What does Maimonides mean? What does he explain? How do you understand it? And the complexities that are written in this commentary are beyond understanding. You would think that he was sitting in a comfortable armchair in a warm house somewhere in New Rochelle with an apple on the table, with an orange, with a cup of hot tea. And there he was able to study in comfort and with peace. But no, he was able to accomplish all this in a very adverse situation. Why is that? Because this is what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had seen in advance. Give me Yavne and its scholars. People who can put the world out of their mind. People who can focus on the task at hand. People who can focus on the Torah, who can focus on the depths of the Torah, so that it's hard to understand how they can even survive. But you look at a Rabbi Steinman and you say, who can survive on a cucumber and a baked potato? And he wrote books too. Rabbi Steinman's books are used in half the yeshivas in the world. The other half just don't understand them. His books are brilliant. And he was the nicest person. He had the warmest smile. This is what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was hoping to accomplish. So when we gather here tonight and we say, what is the secret behind the survival of the Jew? We are not built strong and mighty. We could be frail and feeble and enjoy a couple of spoons of oatmeal for dinner. But we have with us the power of the Torah. And what is the Torah? The Torah is God's word. As one great rabbi once said, he said, when you're praying, you're talking to God. But when you're studying Torah, God is talking to you. So this is what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was talking about when he said to Vespasian, give me Yavne and give me her scholars. I'll conclude with one last thought. Rabbi Yitzchok Huttner, who passed away 36 years ago, was the rabbi who in charge of the yeshiva Rabbi Chaim Berlin. Today it's in a very large building on Coney Island Avenue in Flatbush. It's a beautiful institution, hundreds of students. They have an elementary school, they have a high school, they have a rabbinical college. They call it the school of 1,000 students. So he was a prolific speaker and a prolific writer. And he used to give a public lecture on all the holidays. In the volume of his writings that talk about Hanukkah, in the third essay, he writes an interesting thing. Chronologically, Hanukkah is the last of the Jewish holidays. Right? So you have Pesach, happened when the Jews were in the desert. And Sukkot commemorates when the Jews were in the desert. Shavuos commemorates when God gave us the Torah. That happened when the Jews were in the desert. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur commemorate when God forgave us when we were bad and we worshiped the idol, the golden calf, and Moses broke the Ten Commandments. Purim happened before the Second Temple was built. Hanukkah happened halfway through the period of the Second Temple. So chronologically, Hanukkah is the last of the holidays. And we all say, it says on every dreidel, Nes Gadol Hayah Sham. There was a great miracle that happened there. By the way, I saw it in a Jewish magazine last week, the cutest ad. It said, trade in your dreidel for a new one. And it said, Neis Gadol HaYasham. And then on the bottom it said, Neis Gadol HaYapo. Because in Israel they say a great miracle happened here. So it was an ad promoting people to make aliyah, to move to Israel. And it said, trade in your dreidel for an updated version. So dreidel 2.0. But the Gemara, the Talmud in Yuma says that the miracle of Esther at the time of Purim was the last miracle that occurred. What happened to Hanukkah? Hanukkah was a miracle. It says so on the dreidel. We know it was a miracle. 8 days. You put oil for 1 day, it lasts for 8 days. That's a great miracle. A ragtag team of Maccabees. They were Torah scholars. They were priests. They weren't warriors. They defeated the most mighty, well-trained, best-armed military force in the entire known world. It was a miracle. So why does the Talmud say that the last miracle was Purim? What happened to Hanukkah? So Reb Tzadik HaKohen, who was the rabbi of Lublin, passed away in 1900. He says, Hanukkah comes from the word chinuch. Chinuch is what we refer to education, training. Reb Tzadik HaKohen says that Hanukkah is not connected to the other holidays. Those are holidays of the past. Hanukkah is chinuch. It's training for the future. It is training for the days when the Mashiach will come. It's training for the end of days. When the Jewish Maccabees were able to stand up proud against all odds and were able to say to the world, we will not buckle. We will not give up. We know it's hopeless. We know the odds are against us. We know the pundits say we're going to lose. We know we don't have any uniforms, we don't have any weapons, we don't have any training, we don't have anything. But we're going to fight for what we believe in. Reb Tzadik HaKohen says, that's training for the future. Because that's how the Jews are going to survive when they don't have a temple anymore. And that's how the Jews are going to survive when we don't have an Israel anymore. That's how the Jews are going to survive when we don't have any sovereignty. Wherever we live, we will say, I am proud to be a Jew. I'm going to wear one of these things. I'm proud. And I'm going to stand up for what I believe in. And I'm going to do what I can do, whether other people like it or not. And I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be proud. And I'm going to stand with my head tall. And if some of us get killed, 4 out of the 5 Maccabee brothers got killed in battle over a 20-year period. The one that was left was Shimon. But he stood tall, and they accomplished great things. And Reb Tzadik HaKohen says, and it's quoted by Rabbi Huttner, that this is chinuch for the future. This is training for the future. This is how the Jews survive in the world. So when we gather here tonight at this home in Scarsdale and we look around and we say, there's no Hanukkah Neros. It's a little bit darker tonight. And we go out into the world and it could be a dark world. And the way I see it, it's only getting darker. The world's getting crazy. It's getting darker because people are blowing themselves up in subway stations. And it's getting darker because they're legalizing things that 20 years ago you wouldn't have even thought that they would legalize. and families are coming apart, and communities are coming apart, and it's a dark world. And what do we say? We say it's up to us to bring a little more light into the world. Just like a little Hanukkah candle can light up an entire dark room. A little Jew who is keeping the Torah, a Jew who's studying the Torah, one Jew doing a mitzvah, one Jew studying some Torah, going to a class, opening a Jewish book. And today, there are Jewish books available with any translation you want. You can go into a bookstore, you can get books on any topic you want with a translation, something you can open, you can study, you can read. Anyone can study Torah. It's up to us. We are the descendants of the Maccabees. We are the descendants of our forebears. We carry their DNA within us. We don't know if the Egyptians carry the Pharaoh's DNA. We don't know if the Romans living in Rome carry the Roman DNA. But we carry Jewish DNA. We are Jews. We are proud. And the secret of our survival is the Torah. So everyone, get a piece of the rock, get a piece of Torah, study it, love it, study it in depth, get yourself a study partner, attend a class. You can do it on the phone. You can get a study partner on the phone. They have partners in Torah and Torah mates. There are so many different groups that will set you up once a week. Half an hour in the morning or 45 minutes in the evening, whenever it's convenient. It's up to you. Bring Torah into your life because that is the survival of the Jew. It has been our survival since Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked Vespasian, "Forgive me Yavne and its scholars." And it has sustained us and nourished us and kept us alive and well and healthy until today. Thank you very much and have a pleasant winter. Okay, any questions, comments, criticism, rotten tomatoes, anything? Who brings rotten tomatoes to a lecture? Now, they always joke about, Mrs. Bricks, do you give out rotten tomatoes at the door? I always wondered, people throwing around, who brings rotten tomatoes to a show? Anything? Any comments? You can take these home, yes.
What are the sources for going back and knowing?
It's all recorded. Maimonides, in one of his books, records Jewish history from the time of Moses until his time, which is about 2,200 years. And since then, there have been other authorities who have researched and have written books explaining the transmission of Torah from the time of Maimonides till today, which is something very interesting to think about. If your grandchildren see you, or if you're lucky, if they have a chance to see one of your parents, they are looking at three generations. Your grandchildren, your children, you and your parents. Three generations out of 130 generations going back to Sinai. So that is a significant percentage of the Torah transmission process. When your grandchildren look at you, and they see you, and they see a proud Jew, they're looking at two generations out of 130. So they're looking at 1/65th of the way to Sinai. You know, that is an amazing concept. Your grandchildren to you are 1/65th of the road to Sinai. Now all you have to do is keep up your end of the bargain, and you have to be a proud Jew and be a good Jew, and you have to be a model for them of what it means to keep the traditions. And hopefully they in turn will absorb that and will give it on to their children. And if they're proud, then they're following in the steps of the Maccabees. Anyone else? Yeah, another question?
It's a little, maybe off subject. What do you think of people who are not considered Jewish, non-Jews, who are interested in studying the Torah? Do you consider that some kind of a...
If someone wants to find out more about Jewish life, it's something that is open to anyone. You can go to Barnes & Noble and buy, you know, a book and buy a copy of the Torah in English. I would hope that they would study authentic translations so they get an accurate view of what it means to be Jewish. If they want to find out more, maybe they would consider converting. You know? While we don't actively recruit people, but if someone is interested in genuinely coming under the shelter of God's wings and taking on observance of the Torah, no, we will encourage that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Schwartz. I'd like to not only thank Rabbi Schwartz, but I'd like to point out something that's obvious to everybody in this room. It's very fortunate and very understandable that someone with such passion, such clarity, such vision, we understand why he has a major share in building Torah from coast to coast in his position. We're very, very grateful. It's an honor to have you with us. After the last lecture, one person came over to me and asked me if he could call you up. I'm wondering how many calls I'm going to get tomorrow morning. So I would like to, I have an announcement about something that we just succeeded in putting on our calendar today. We have a once a year a spectacular musical program called the Kumsitz. And we've just scheduled it for Motzei Shabbos Saturday night, January 27th. So there'll be information available about that. Definitely put that on your calendar. It's like it's a spectacular event. And we are also in the process of planning our next lecture for mid-January. And every Monday night, if we want to follow Rabbi Schwartz's prescription, every Monday night we have an opportunity to study Torah at the headquarters of Jeff Inman Maranak. We have a weekly class. And the class is called Spiritual Scuba Diving. So bring a towel, and I can assure you you'll have quite a time. Yes? What's that? Oh, yes. Thank you. My memory came with me tonight. And, yes, because of the holiday schedule at large, next week's Monday night class will be taking place on Wednesday night at 8:30 of Amerinac. The information is on our website. That's the place to really stay informed about what we're doing. JeffOfWestchester.com. And if you want to become a scholar in our events, go on. You can click on and get our emails for upcoming events. Have a safe trip home, everybody. And thank you again. We don't have a minion?
I don't think so.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, we want to thank Howie and Chani again for their spectacular hospitality, and everybody's invited to partake in the wonderful refreshments they've put out.
What was the name of the yeshiva that he's great? Chabot
Chai. Very
nice. So he's in charge of the whole thing?
No, he's the executive. He's the Rosh Yeshiva. There are rabbis who have a position.
So he's the Rosh Yeshiva.
He's not the Rosh Yeshiva. He is the the executive vice president. So he makes sure that the yeshiva is able to.
I keep the lights on.
He's not executive vice president. Yes.
Of the main branch of the yeshiva.
Of the main branch.
Right.
That's the one in Brooklyn.
In Kew Garden Hills.
In Queens.
I thought the main one was in Brooklyn.
No.
No, we started the one in Brooklyn.
The branch.
Okay. Because that's a big.
It's a very big. Yeah. There are almost 1,000 kids there.
I know. I've been there.
Yeah. Should come to see us in Queens. You'll be very impressed.
Where is the one in Queens?
It's in Kew Garden Hills on 76th Avenue. It takes up a whole block from 76th Avenue to 76th Road.
I'm sure it does.
You know where Main Street is?
Sure.
We're one block east of Main Street. Do you know where the Main Street post office is?
Yeah.
We're one block east of it. Come by sometime. I'll give you a tour. You'll be very impressed.
Sometimes.
Sure. Oh, sure. I remember him so well. He used to come every year to the dinner, and he used to love coming.
They came together.
His office was in New Hyde Park, right?
That's right.
I remember. I went to visit him in the office.
Yeah.
How long is it he's gone? 4 years?
That's your car. Okay, very great.